This podcast is a good one. Let's not muck around. We're breaking down insulin with sports dietitian Harriet Walker. Let's go.
Welcome to the Body Science Podcast, bringing you everything you need, want, and should know about health, fitness, nutrition, and training. As always, the information contained in this podcast is for the information purposes only and is not designed to diagnose or be prescriptive to treat, prevent, or manage any injury, disease, or other health-related condition. Body Science organic apple cider vinegar capsules with the mother are keto and vegan friendly. Apple cider vinegar is rich in acetic acid and has been used as a natural health supplement for centuries. Did you know apple cider vinegar actually increases ketosis, which is great news for all you keto fans out there. ACV is reported to improve your energy levels and boosts keto clarity. For the rest of us not living keto, adding apple cider vinegar to your diet may benefit a healthy gut, healthy hair, skin, and nails, and weight management, helping you feel good inside and out. If you find apple cider vinegar a little difficult to swallow, Body Science organic apple cider vinegar comes in a convenient capsule form and can be added to any meal plan, meal prep, or smoothie.
Welcome to the Body Science Podcast. Today with me, sports dietitian, clinical dietitian, accredited dietitian, and the way I'm throwing the word dietitian around because we're going to talk about a really interesting topic today, insulin. So we're going to break insulin down. Now, Harriet is here because she is obviously qualified to talk about insulin, can talk about it from the fitness industry point of view, training point of view, clinical application. And let's get down to the basics and dispel some myths and talk about what actually is insulin. Like, absolutely. Bring it on or back it off? Where are we at?
Well, I think we need to start from the top here, and we're looking at insulin as a hormone in the body. So we need to know a few things about hormones and their roles in the body before we get started. So it's important to know insulin is a peptide hormone. So it's made out of amino acids. We get a chain of amino acids, they link together, they form the protein, and that's basically what a hormone is. There's different types of hormones in the body. And what hormones do, they're like chemical messengers. So if there's something going on in the environment that the body is not sure is conducive to good health or life, we will get this cascade effect of chemical messengers being sent around the body to let all the different cells in the body know that we need to correct something. What we're looking at is, again, the concept that we've talked about in quite a few podcasts, which is homeostasis, which is the ideal level of everything in the body where everything is happy and healthy and everything is functioning well. So when we get a deviation from homeostasis, we get these messengers around the body to say, hey guys, let's change something in order to bring us back to that baseline where we're really happy.
So let's not muck around. Insulin, where is that in POPs? Where are we sitting when you say everything's perfect and aligned and the world's beautiful? Like,
so
you hear about insulin everywhere you go.
Yeah, and I think it's important to take a step back and look at what its role in the body is, because at the end of the day, everything that our body produces is there for a reason.
Yep.
It's when it's in excess that it becomes an issue. Insulin is there. It's a hormone that was discovered in 1921, and it is there to clear out excess glucose from the blood. Now, that's the key role that we know now that it does. And there may be a few other roles that it plays. But specifically at the moment, we are looking at insulin as a way of bringing blood glucose levels down.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that important? Excess glucose in the blood is toxic. So we have a happy level of glucose in the blood that we require to keep our muscles going, to keep all the cells in our body going, to provide energy. We store glucose in the liver. We store glucose in the muscles. And we have a small amount in the blood at any one stage to allow our body to work optimally. So when we have a meal, our blood glucose levels go up, and to a point that's not going to kill us, obviously, otherwise we'd probably die after each meal. But insulin's role is to sense that change in the environment. We get the food is broken down into glucose as the smallest common denominator, and basically there's a cascade of signals in the body that says, okay, we've got glucose in excess to our preference and we need to bring this down. So that's when insulin is sent out to signal to the cells that we can bring this glucose into the cell.
Why don't we just not eat carbs?
Because we need carbohydrates in the body, and it's not just about carbs. So we do actually also get an insulin response from protein and from fat.
Yep.
It is not as pronounced,
so
which is why we look at glucose as the key driver of insulin response.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically a normal part of healthy body working. We don't need to get rid of insulin. It plays an important role in our bodies. Insulin becomes an issue is like with everything when it's in too large an amount, and it's not necessarily insulin in a large amount that's the issue. It's the blood sugar levels at that heightened range that is is the issue. Mm-hmm. And this brings us back down to what's actually getting our blood glucose level that high in the first place. So that's really the key here. It's insulin's not necessarily the bad guy. It's doing its job. But if we're not eating in a way that's conducive to healthy blood sugar levels, that's when we see that issue and that outside of normal ranges on a regular basis.
So let's not muck around. I just ate a block of chocolate. What happened?
You have.
And we're talking a block, not a little tiny chocolate.
So basically what happens is we consume food. We get a release of glucose into the blood. So that food is going into our stomach. It's been broken down by enzymes in the gut. Those little tiny molecules, glucose molecules, are being transported into the bloodstream. It goes to the liver. So the liver is the first point of call for glucose. If you've just done a little bit of exercise or for whatever reason you haven't eaten in a while, the first thing that glucose is going to do in the liver is going to replenish liver glycogen levels.
What if I haven't exercised and I've eaten a block of chocolate?
Probably won't get any uptake of glucose from your liver, mm-hmm. but then it might go to other tissues in the body. So all of our...
When you say might, what do you mean by might?
Probably will go to other tissues. So there's a few different stages when it comes to getting rid of glucose in the body. First one is to replenish glycogen. Second one is obviously initial energy, then glycogen. And if it doesn't get used as energy, we can store it as triglycerides in fat cells. So we have a pretty much infinite ability to store excess energy as fat. And so that is the end sort of status of excess glucose from the diet. We see an increase in fat cells around the body. So all of
our... So that's why you eat chocolate, you get fat?
Largely, yes. Yeah, yes.
Gotcha.
That's in a calorie deficit.
Sorry to put that
in a calorie excess.
Dumbed down method there.
No, that's okay. So everything in excess, if it's excess coconut oil or if it's excess anything like that, is going to cause a calorie surplus and that's going to get stored.
A little bit off track here, and I know you like it when I do this.
Oh, I love it.
I got a mate who eats a block of chocolate at night. Why not? He's eating a block of chocolate at 8 o'clock at night. When is this issue really happening? Because he's on the couch, he's watching TV. I've eaten the block of chocolate. How much later in my body process is this happening?
It takes around 4 to 6 hours for our blood glucose to be cleared back to normal levels in a healthy person. So we are assuming that if this person had eaten within a calorie budget and that chocolate hadn't tipped him over, then that would be cleared.
Well, I'd say most people eating chocolate at night aren't in a calorie budget.
No, 100% not. So this is when we get...
I'm trying to look at the danger of this. Like, I want to put a few little case scenarios together and then you can talk more about what you want to talk about. But these are the things we get asked. How long after eating chocolate is the problem happening?
Absolutely.
So if I eat a block of chocolate and I hit the gym 30 minutes later, or if I eat a block of chocolate and I hit the couch 30 minutes later...
We've got two different scenarios.
Absolutely,
and it depends if that is a one-off occurrence. Mm-hmm. That is probably not, it's obviously not ideal to eat a block of chocolate sitting on the couch, but look, it happens.
So this is happening at night, you're asleep, your body's in repair, whatever it does when it's asleep, but you've got this massive sugar rush happening.
Yeah. So what your body is doing is using insulin. Insulin is released from the pancreas. So the pancreas is the organ that produces insulin from what we call little cells, the islets of Langerhans. So that's...
The what, sorry?
Islets of Langerhans.
Sounds like a song.
Yeah. So Langerhans was the bloke who discovered pancreatic beta cells.
Okay.
The beta cells get told that there's too much glucose in the blood.
Insulin, and what does it do about it when it tells it that?
Insulin gets drawn to the surface of the cell.
Yep.
And it gets released into the bloodstream. From the bloodstream, insulin goes to the surface of cells in our body. So all of our cells have capacity to absorb glucose. So this insulin sticks to the cell.
Yep.
And then we get an uptake of GLUT4 transporters. So GLUT4 transporters are little proteins that stick like little straws through the cell, mm-hmm. and they can suck in excess glucose from the blood. So what's happening with your mate who's sitting on the couch after eating a block of chocolate? If he's just done this once, body's going to be working pretty hard. Obviously, we don't need the energy, so there's going to be a surplus there likely. Yep. But if he's doing this every night for a number of nights or probably months or years, we get a progression of insulin resistance potentially.
Okay, so what's insulin resistance?
Insulin resistance refers to the sort of state where we've got poor blood glucose control. So we're probably getting our glucose too high too often, and we're getting an influx of insulin into the bloodstream at a rate that is...
So why is that a bad thing?
Well, if we're constantly throwing out insulin into the blood, our cells can actually become resistant to it. So they won't actually answer the call to bring glucose back into the cell to bring our glucose levels back to normal.
So what's happening then?
So what we're having is an excess of glucose in the blood, which we know is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that we need external sources of insulin potentially to bring our glucose back down. And that's what we're talking about in terms of the progression progression from insulin resistance to type 2 diabetes.
Which is a massive worldwide problem.
Massive issue. So we've got two different kinds of diabetes. Yep. We've got type 1 diabetes, where the pancreas, which is the organ that secretes insulin, it doesn't produce any insulin at all. So what we have is an issue of not enough insulin. And then we've got type 2 diabetes, which is more of an issue of too much insulin too regularly. Our cells become unresponsive to the call and no longer sucks in insulin into the cell. And then we have this buildup of glucose into the blood. We see that after a meal, instead of after 4 to 6 hours going back to normal, we see elevated levels of glucose for a long period of time. That causes inflammation in the body, and that also increases potentially the, you know, we've got dyslipidemia, which is a term that we use for excess fat in the blood, because when we get excess calories being taken in and turned into triglycerides, which is a fat storage unit that is in the blood. So when we have a sort of a disease state with type 2 diabetes, what we're seeing is poorly controlled blood glucose levels. We're seeing increased triglycerides in the blood. We're seeing the body's inability to actually respond to the call of insulin. So insulin is not necessarily the cause of the issue. Mm-hmm. It is a byproduct of poorly controlled blood glucose levels as a result of overconsumption.
Why are both those called diabetes?
They're both to do with insulin. So, you know.
And does diabetes definition around the word insulin?
Insulin,
is it?
Yeah. Okay. So we've got the body's inability to regulate blood glucose levels. One is because we don't produce any insulin, and we see type 1 diabetics having to inject to match their food. And then in the other case, we see insulin's not doing its job. So the cells of the body are no longer responding to the call of insulin. They're both diabetes, but they're one's more lifestyle related. And type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, which is potentially from birth, or we can see it coming on early 20s.
Early 20s, why is that?
I'm not actually quite sure about the progression of it, but we do see either sort of early stage diabetes and that sort of juvenile diabetes. And when we see, as we go through, I think it might be something to do with puberty, going through different, you know, growth spurts and whatnot later in late 20s. Generally, see a lot of people being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in their early 20s.
Is it genetic?
The autoimmune tends to have a genetic component to it. Mm-hmm. And then type 2 diabetes actually has a risk factor that is genetically linked as well. And that sort of tends to do with the lifestyle factors associated with type 2 diabetes. So being overweight is a risk factor for diabetes and vice versa. If we're overweight, we're more likely to be progressing into diabetes from poor blood glucose control.
So what are dietitians worldwide doing about diabetes?
Well, I think one of the two...
Type 2, sorry, I'm talking about.
Yeah, type 2 diabetes. The two key things that we can do with diabetes is lifestyle-related changes. So we're looking at increasing exercise. We have increasing lean muscle mass, and we know that muscle independent of insulin assists in pulling glucose into the cell. So sort of a more of a mechanical pathway that it does that.
Dumb question, because I'm full of them. If I'm got a very lean muscular physique and I'm eating a lot of chocolate because I'm energy starved, am I running the gauntlet as well?
Potentially. Excess sugar can cause issues with metabolism generally. Like when we don't encourage even healthy people, it's about healthy habits long term. So if I'm in the habit at 25 of consuming a diet that, you know, because I can get away with it, I'm having lots of sugar in my diet, I'm not really setting myself up to habits that are conducive for later in life when I probably can't get away with it as much because my energy needs have dropped.
Yep.
I've got this habit of eating a block of chocolate a night, but all of a sudden I've had this step down in my metabolic rate due to age, and I'm not as responsive. Or I might have stopped exercising as much as I did when I was 25. As a result of that, my body is not as good at utilizing that excess glucose from big bolus of carbohydrate. So what we can look at from a dietary perspective, and especially with carbohydrates, is focusing on lower glycemic index carbohydrates.
So we're still talking GI, are we, these days?
We're still talking GI, but there is information and context around it that we need to keep in mind. Yep. So glycemic index is the term used to describe the glucose response that a food has upon ingestion. So if I consume a piece of bread, what impact that, how much does it raise my blood glucose levels? What we're looking at with glycemic index is the impact that it has on blood glucose levels and how quickly and how readily that our blood can bring that down, because that takes into account the insulin factor as well. So I want to consume foods that have a slow peak and a slow steady, like if you think about a mountain, you don't want a sharp peak. You want a slow steady rise in blood glucose levels, and your body only has to secrete a small amount of insulin to bring those blood glucose levels back down to normal. Whereas if I'm constantly peaking my blood glucose levels up and down, the beta cells get a little bit tired spread out. Sometimes they might not be able to secrete as much insulin as needed to pull the glucose out. And then in other sort of scenarios, the insulin isn't actually working, doing its thing in terms of letting the glucose back into the cell.
If you're suffering that insulin resistance, and tell me if I'm using incorrect terminology, is there something you can do as a lifestyle change to accelerate the program of healing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one is looking at the types of carbohydrates you're having. Two is probably going to be reducing your carbohydrate intake for a period of time. So we can see people resensitizing their body to insulin. So, you know, there are circumstances where people have actually reversed their type 2 diabetes through diet and exercise and come off whatever medication it is that they're taking. But it takes a lot of work and lifestyle change to be able to do that. So we want to make sure that people are reducing their total calorie intake and losing weight. And we also want to make sure that they're being a little bit more specific with the types of carbohydrate that they are taking in. And this is a case where, you know, a lower carbohydrate diet is probably appropriate for somebody who wants to take a lifestyle approach and reduce their blood glucose levels in order to increase their control. And they might do that for a period of time and be testing along the way, making sure, and we can actually test for these things, and it's quite well established the patterns of testing that we can do for blood glucose. So there's a glucose tolerance test that we use to diagnose diabetes. And then after that, we're looking at long-term control of diabetes. And the people who utilize diet and exercise really well, they're actually in some cases coming off their medication. And we see that in fact that the type 2 diabetes is under control and they may not have it anymore. So there's a spectrum of what we need to do. Insulin resistance, that's when we probably want to get people before it actually progresses into full-blown type 2 diabetes.
Should people go to the doctor and ask for those tests?
Absolutely. Like, yeah. I think if we were having this conversation earlier, how do you know if there's an issue? For the fact that, you know, we see a sort of a phenotype or a specific body type associated, and that's definitely if you've got the excess weight around your middle. If you know that your diet isn't necessarily fantastic, and I'm talking we're eating that block of chocolate every night, we're having that, you know, carton of ice cream, you know, each night. And these are an inactivity as well. So if you're in a sedentary job, you don't do any kind of exercise, they're all sort of risk factors that we would associate with higher risk of type 2 diabetes. You know, we can be testing this. So we're testing glucose tolerance, but we're also testing blood lipids as well. Because like we said before, when we have poor blood glucose control, we see an increase of those excess calories being converted into triglycerides, which are the storage form. You know, these are all normal things within a normal range, but once we get outside that range, it becomes more of a diseased state. So I think it's important to step back and look at everything within the body, hormones and otherwise. They're there for a reason. We don't necessarily, like, insulin isn't the bad guy. And in many cases, you know, insulin in and of itself can be anti-inflammatory because it is reducing the state of hypoglycemia, which is a pro-inflammatory state. You know, if we're looking at it in black and white terms, it's anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. But when we have excess of anything, that's when we tend to move into those less optimal states in the body that cause or that start the disease progression.
So is insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity and all the insulin words you've been throwing around the last 5 minutes, do other factors outside of diet affect that?
Absolutely.
Caffeine?
Yeah. So I suppose stress would be one that would come up quite regularly for people, because when we look at insulin, we have to look at the opposing hormone, which is glucagon. So insulin is secreted in order to reduce blood glucose levels. Glucagon does the opposite. So it's the opposing hormone and it is used to increase blood glucose levels. And so we have to look at what stage in the game are we wanting to increase blood glucose levels? And that would be in a state of fight or flight. So we're in a stressed state. We actually increase, we release that stored blood glucose through glycolysis and we are increasing circulating glucose in the blood in order to be able to respond to the threat. So that might be to run away, it might be to fight, or as we have discussed earlier, we're sitting in our own pool of glucose and that's pro-inflammatory. So it's not just in a state of, you know, food that is happening. Obviously, that's probably the more common one. But we're also, if we're doing the double whammy of poor diet, excess calories, and a high stress situation, then we have a really good recipe for that sort of metabolic disease. So when we're looking at hormones, there's generally speaking always an opposing hormone. So when we're looking at insulin, we have the opposing hormone, which is glucagon.
That's not a cool name, glucagon. I don't like it.
Glucagon.
I don't think I want to use that name anymore.
Glucose gone.
Ah, okay. Glucagon, no. Yeah. Is that how you remember it at uni?
No, it's not, because it's actually awful. Insulin's probably more glucose gone.
Yeah.
Glucagon is increasing blood glucose levels. And we associate glucagon with the other hormones like epinephrine or adrenaline and cortisol. So when we are stressed, we see adrenaline, cortisol go up. We also see glucagon going up, and they're the sort of catabolic hormones, whereas insulin is probably more associated as being an anabolic hormone where we see build up and storage.
So what's more dangerous, excess food insulin or excess stress insulin?
Well, I think they're six of one, half a dozen of the other. I think anything in excess chronically in the body is going to be an issue.
Because, so, I mean, we can eat 6-8 times a day, which could be excessive or it could be good eating, but we can be stressed 100 times a day.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose when it comes to insulin being secreted in response to food, we might also see an excess of calories. Then we see an excess of calories being converted into fat. Then we see fat being stored in the body. We see increased triglycerides. No.
Is that why when I'm having a bad day and I'm stressed, I want to go and happy eat?
Potentially, yes.
For that 10 minutes of feeling unreal?
So we eat not just for physiological reasons. We also eat for hedonic reasons. We see that increase.
What reasons?
Hedonic.
Nice word.
Yeah.
We
don't just eat because we feel the need as a result of hunger cues. We eat because we get a reward out of food. And that's okay. Like, that's just standard human behavior. But when we're doing it all the time, we see probably the sort of the hedonic response, which is an increase in dopamine. We get that sort of happy feeling after eating lots of calories.
What did Luke call it? Dopamine lollipops?
Dopamine lollipops. Yeah, what we need to do is get a handle of that stress. If we're stressed and we're not actually eating excess calories, we're probably going to lose weight because we've got that cortisol, we've got that adrenaline, we're actually burning through energy. And you'll see people who are quite stressed, sometimes they can be quite thin because their body is, you know, constantly in that state of stress. They're burning through the calories at a higher rate. And if they're not consuming in excess, they're not going to necessarily see the issue with excess insulin in response to excess calories. So it is really what is the issue here is the excess calories. And we can go about a number of different ways to bring down, you know, the calorie intake, reduce the fat content of the body and bring those insulin levels back into normal range.
So I've got a big one for you here. Say I'm running a diet if it meets my macros.
Yep.
Person A might be having 6 calorie controlled meals a day. Person B might be having 2 to 3 meals, but absolutely smashing those meals. What is the difference in same calories?
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say they're not weight loss calories, they're just calories. And
yep.
Obviously you wouldn't be on if it fits your macro. Where are we at with a person that's eating 6 times a day, like say 300 calories in a meal, 1800 calories, versus someone who's having 2 900s?
Yeah, 2 big chunks of food.
Yeah. And they'd be loving life too, those 2 900s.
Yeah, that's a cracking meal.
That's a great meal.
Look, if the person is healthy, there doesn't have to be a big issue with having 6.
So it's not the time of it being in your body, it's amount of it in your body.
It's probably the amount, probably the blood glucose levels. If we've got large spikes, if we're eating a whole lot of, you know, sugar within those small meals, we might see an increase in insulin levels to a point where it becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person is healthy and they've got, you know, good blood glucose control, then there's no issues with eating 6 meals a day. But, you know, if we've got somebody who's in that sort of early stages of type 2 diabetes or that sort of metabolic syndrome, then potentially giving them a break and letting their insulin levels come down, their blood glucose levels come down, that could be beneficial in order to just pull back on that disease progression a little bit. So we're really looking at healthy state versus disease state here and the person's ability to deal with glucose. So if you've got a very active person, they could be smashing food all day long.
Yep.
And look, we don't really necessarily know all the ins and outs of insulin resistance right now. I mean, insulin was discovered in 1920. It sounds like a long time, you know, 100
really.
Years ago, but in terms of science and, you know, being able to actually test this stuff, we're still finding out different ways in which this hormone is actually working in the body. So it's still, you know, there's still some mechanisms that still haven't been fully identified.
Let's wrap this breaking down insulin, because we're going to actually get you back to do a more in-depth one next week, because I think this is more than just one big long podcast on insulin.
Absolutely.
Let's break it down. It's a little bit more technical. I'll shut up more in the next one. Let's go a really quick breakdown on insulin brings glucose into the cell by
the pancreas senses that there's an increase in glucose in the blood.
Yep.
This signals the release, so insulin release from the pancreatic beta cells. Beta cells release the insulin. Insulin goes to the cell, any sort of cell, so it might be the muscle cell. It stimulates the GLUT4 transporter onto the cell surface, and that GLUT4, if you think of a little straw that goes in between a cell, gets sucked in and glucose is brought into the cell. So that's sort of the very basic thing. It'd be great to have
clear as mud. Look forward to your next masterclass.
Oh, we'll see you then.
This week's podcast was brought to you by our premium partners, Nutrition Warehouse Nationally, ASN Nationally, Mr. Supplement, Sporty's Warehouse, Fat Burners Only, and Evren Fay.